here's a chance to get the Audible audiobook read by me free. Here's how it works. If you have a subscription to unknowncountry.com for a year or more on January the 12th, you will be automatically entered into a drawing where we will choose 50 unknowncountry.com subscribers to receive free New World audiobooks. If you're not an annual subscriber but would like to upgrade, that's simple to do. Just enter your account and find the upgrade button and take it from there. If you're not a subscriber at all, now's the time. Get a 1 year or more subscription to unknowncountry.com in order to be entered into this drawing on the 12th. Winners may cancel their subscriptions at any time, of course, but if you win the audiobook, you will not receive a refund for the first year of service. So go to unknowncountry.com and sign up now for a year or more. There will be another drawing like this later on in the year. And other premiums also are going to be offered throughout the year. So enjoy the site and enjoy all of the benefits of being an unknowncountry.com subscriber.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, as we journey across the change of year, who else should I have on but Linda Moulton Howe? We've been talking to scientists who have had close encounter experiences recently, Ed Bell Bruno and Deep Prasad. Now, Linda is not a close encounter witness in that sense, but she has been deeply involved in the scientific journey that is associated with the materials and to an extent with the close encounter witnesses also. In my new book, A New World, which Linda has read, we start out literally in the first, I guess in chapter two, with a hypothesis. The hypothesis is that there are different ways of looking at the world, what I call an input strategy and an output strategy. We use an output strategy. When you look at an apple, you see an apple. Someone else might use an input strategy. When they look at an apple, they might see the array of fractals that make it up in its deeper reality. Now, when Linda read that in the book, she immediately called me and said, Whitley, you are missing something. A very important. There is someone that this has already happened to. Now it's in the book. So if you read the book now, you will find this reference there. So Linda, let's start by first saying Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Linda Moulton Howe. And then we'll roll right into the material that you brought me about this particular change in perception.
Well, Whitley, I would like to say not only Merry Christmas and Happy New Year that we're going into 2020, but that 2020, I hope, is finally the breakthrough year for that headline, We're Not Alone in the Universe, and that your book, the very cover, is to me at the profound heart of why there is both trepidation and tremendous enthusiasm within my own being about getting that headline out, We're Not Alone. And then on the other side of the headline is, who are we dealing with? Why have they interacted with this planet for millions of years? What is their ability to move point to point? What is their relationship to all of the other dimensions that appear to be the bigger truth? That this universe is not the only universe, that this dimension is not the only dimension, that just like fractals in fractal math, it's cycles and circles, so that we are in a cosmos with a capital C, with an infinite number of dimensions, an infinite number of universes, an infinite number potentially of other consciousnesses. And that brings me right to where I remember picking your book up and staring at the cover. I'm reading the quote there over and over. This book is contact, quote unquote. Jeff Kripal, PhD, author of Mutants and Mystics. And then right below that profound quote is your title, A New World. And both you and I met Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso at the 50th anniversary of the crashes at Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1997. And there, when I was introduced to Colonel Corso, he smiled broadly and he shook my hand. And as he did so, he said, "Linda, how the hell have you gotten so many confidential pieces of information in your book?"
That's the question, isn't it, Linda?
Yeah, and at that time, I had two out, An Alien Harvest and Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1. Volume 2 had not come out yet. And he proceeded at the 50th anniversary to talk with me for a few hours about animal mutilations being one of the interactions from other intelligences and this planet that he knew for a fact, because when he had worked for what would have been Eisenhower's choice, General Arthur Trudeau, for the first R&D head in the Army, that General Trudeau, who had known Philip Corso during World War II in the Italian campaign, General Trudeau had reached out to his old friend, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, to come in to the Pentagon and work for him, General Trudeau, on what? And Philip Corso told me at that 50th anniversary that the first thing that General Trudeau did when he had him come to his office in the Pentagon, General Trudeau got up, walked over to two or three four-drawer brown file cabinets. And he began opening with one drawer and then explained to Colonel Corso that when he lifted out what looked to him, to Colonel Corso, like maybe a bunch of plastic wires, that it had come from the crash of a UFO in New Mexico in 47, and that this is what was in the walls of the craft. And then he picked up what looked like poker chips. This is what Colonel Corso said. Picked up these poker chips, which under a microscope were traced with infinitely delicate lines that we have come to know in our world of computers today as being at the heart of superconductors and for what makes computers run. And on he went through the thing that would project a line of red light that we have come to know as lasers. All of these things, he said, between General Trudeau and himself in that Pentagon office were discussed, and that this discussion was taking place at the very early 60s. And as he described this technology to me, he said to me, "Linda, there is a new world coming if we can take it." And I can hear him right now as he talked to me on that July day in 1997 saying those words. And I'm looking at a copy of his book that came out exactly at that same time. And that when he did the day after Roswell, he opened up the cover of the book that he was handing to me. He handed me the book, and I treasure it. And inside, he had written, "It's a new world coming, if you can take it." Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, July 1997.
Well, that is a real collector's item. I do not have such a book, but he said he also had a very long one-on-one conversation with me and Anne. And he said the same thing to us. and told us how he had heard that phrase and where it had come from. And, you know,
well, that's exactly what I was just going to say, to throw it to you, that that day in July of 1997, in the first week of July of 1997, to resonate with at least three UFO crashes that took place between July 2nd and 4th, we now know that in the work that he had done for General Arthur Trudeau, one of his assignments was to go to White Sands, then Proving Ground in the old days, missile range today. And there he said he met with an extraterrestrial biological entity that was tall, and that that being telepathed to him, Lieutenant Colonel Corso, those words.
And,
it's
know,
a new world coming, if you can take
if
it.
If you can take it. And the second he said that to us and nudged me, and I knew immediately what she meant, that this was true.
Yeah.
This was the real thing.
That's right. And I think of him actually often because of that enigmatic sentence, that hanging on the other side of it that day in July, hanging now as you and I talk at the end of December 2019, all of the years lived in between, that those prophetic words of Colonel Corso are what you and I and so many others are sensing is about to come upon us in a real, real way, palpable, that we have been hoping for, that huge headline, "We're not alone in the universe." But on the other side of saying that, we then have, what is it going to be like for us matter creatures to coexist, interact with, periodic? Okay, your first two chapters set up answers to that question.
Linda, we're going to take a brief break, and after we come back, we're going to start talking about those very answers. Linda Moulton Howe's website is earthfiles.com. You can find her on her fabulous YouTube channel with a really cool live broadcast every Wednesday night when she is not recovering from the flu, which is not often. She's almost always there. And it's a great show. I watch it every week, and so do my kids' cats, by the way, who are fascinated with Linda's cats. We'll be right back.
Every week, Unknown Country subscribers go way out on the cutting edge and get fascinating firsthand information that you are not going to find anywhere else. Listen as Dr. John Lerma describes what happened when he tried to remove Whitley Strieber's implant.
There was one thing I don't think we ever really talked about, I guess because it was so new to me, and that was how it affected the surrounding tissue. And that was, it didn't affect the surrounding tissue. There was no inflammatory response noted at all.
Being an Unknown Country subscriber makes you part of a very special community. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on that subscribe tab right now.
You can find the interview with Dr. John Lerma about my implant and so much more in the unknowncountry.com subscriber section, an archive dating back to 2004 filled with fascinating information. And for $5 a month or less, it is just an unbeatable deal. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe now.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
For this break, I'd like to talk about A New World, my new book, which is getting great reviews on Amazon. It's available on Amazon, on Apple Books, on Kobo, and practically everywhere in the world that ebooks are sold, even in China. So if you are listening abroad, go to your local ebook retailer and you can find A New World. If you're here in the U.S., Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Amazon are all waiting for you. Plus, you can get the paperback on Barnes & Noble and on Amazon. And as always, if you want me to sign your paperback, just send a copy of it to Whitley Strieber at 1112 Montana Avenue, Santa Monica, California, 90403. Include a stamped self-addressed return envelope, and I will sign your copy immediately and return it to you. I love to do that. Plus, if you have questions about the book, write me at whitley@strieber.com. Or if you're a subscriber, come to the chat room on Wednesday nights at 7. I'm available. A New World. It's an important, valuable book. Look it over everywhere books are sold. And if you want to get it into your local retailer, just ask them to order it. We're talking to Linda Moulton Howe at the beginning of 2020. Is 2020 going to be the year that the general scientific and academic communities admit the truth and start getting their heads around the reality that somebody who ain't us really is here? Linda, we were just talking about the answers to those questions. Critical questions. Why don't you just pick it up?
I don't know about you, Whitley, but when I am truly absorbed by any book that I'm reading, I always have sticky notes nearby. And the better a book is, the more filled it becomes. And they are in my bookshelves with the original notes that I took upon reading, including Colonel Corso's book is the same. Well, yours, A New World. It must have 100 in them. And one, and the very first one that is always to me interesting, where will I place my first sticky note? Here's where I placed it. I have noticed, this is you, a strange sense of perfection attaching to sounds and movements made by the visitors. It is really uncanny, and every time I see it, the idea that I am dealing with a conscious machine comes to mind. One of them once made a very telling comment to a close encounter witness. It told her, quote, "We arrange atoms," close quote. That was my first note in reading your book, "We Arrange Atoms." And it sits right across from the page of the previous page 20. And that is where you wrote, "I think that there is evidence that the visitors see the principles first and the apple only later. They use an input strategy in order to organize reality in their minds. In other words, they think the same way a machine does. That they may therefore be machines doesn't seem to me to be impossible either, nor does the idea that a machine might be conscious." And this is where the whole idea of an apple that we were talking about and that you use as a metaphor, that we are dealing with alien minds that would see the fractals and the math that went into the placement of the atoms. We arrange atoms, not what we humans see. We see the end product. We see an apple. Either at a new stage, we begin to be educated enough living on Earth that we can tell when an apple is, quote-unquote, ripe to eat, and we can also see when it has passed that stage and is perhaps rotting on the vine. That entire bell-shaped curve of phases and conditions are well known to humans, but we never see the apple as fractals, as even atoms arranged in this miraculous way. And once you begin to sink your mind into that concept and you start looking at everything around you completely differently, you come to Struck by Genius. This is a two-part Earth Files that I did in March 29th of 2017 after doing a very long interview with a genius. But he didn't start out as a genius. His name is Jason Paget. And he was introduced to me by a writer in New York who said, "You need to talk with a man who was beat up, of all things, in the parking lot of a bar and he was beat nearly to death. But when he woke up in the hospital, Jason Padgett was no longer seeing what we humans see. He was seeing everywhere around him fractal geometries. Everything had turned into fractal geometries. And as I talked to him, I said, how do you move on this planet? How do you relate to your wife and children? How do you walk through a door if every single thing you are seeing is fractal geometries? And he said something that is so perfect for your book. He said, I have just learned to see through the fractals, to see through the math, and then I can focus on the world that you see. And somewhere in this work with Jason Padgett and all of his, get this, if you go to earthfiles.com and you type in 3D hologram or Jason Padgett, P-A-D-G-E-T-T, and you look at the Earth Files that I did with him in March of 2017, and you see the line says they are hand-drawn. The book, Struck by Genius, about how this all came to be after he was beaten up so almost to death, is that he says that in his mind, quote, that his hand to his mind seemed to move without him ever having to direct anything, which is what humans are used to. He said he just lets his hand move with his mind, and then these extraordinarily detailed fractals come in to being, and that mathematical people in universities have examined these hand-drawn fractals by Jason Padgett, and that they cannot believe it, that they are perfect.
And that gets me back to the eerie perfection.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Of the grace.
In your book, you talk about this presence with a capital P that has this eerie perfection that you have felt.
Yes, exactly. Now, that gets me to the fascinating, to me, question of whether or not at least some of our visitors may be machines, because I think that might be the case. And I think the great physicist John von Neumann was allegedly a member of the Majestic scientific group that studied the Roswell materials. And he probably was, actually. And now that we are quite certain that there were and are Roswell materials, I mean, I think you know, and I certainly do know people who work on those materials to this day. So they're real, period. And my own uncle confirmed that in my life years ago. So that's kind of case closed. Which gets me to something that Dr. von Neumann published back in the old days before his death in the early 50s, which was something called the von Neumann machine. The concept was that a machine could be built that would be capable of replicating a species in incredible detail and then sent out into the galaxy to search for planets where the species could live. And he estimated that it would be able to going at something like 90% of the speed of light, that it would be able to find a viable planet with probably within 50,000 years. And it was all guesswork in those days, of course. But the thing that might not have been guesswork is the idea of the machine. He may have known that such a machine existed and was here.
Well, remember, we were talking about this the other day when I asked you genuinely, because you raised this issue about whether we're dealing with at least some kind of artificial intelligence in some of the entities that interact with Earth, and I ask you what you've really felt, because that AI issue keeps coming up more and more in my own investigations. And you said to me, yes, that you thought that that was definitely possible. And I was asking you specifically about the gray types.
Right.
They seem to come in a menagerie of sizes, and it's extremely confusing even to people who have long been in the human abduction syndrome.
Almost as if they're purpose-built.
Well, yes, exactly. And then jump to the long, involved, seven-hour discussion that I had in December of 1999 with a man who was an analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency, no question. He was retiring. And the meeting had been set up by a man who worked in the World Bank, who had seen me at conferences, had made all kinds of, I'm going to say, friendly, Linda, if you are in New York, please call me. We will get together and go to dinner, and I would like to stay in touch with you. And I came to the conclusion that the World Bank man was working for the CIA or the NSA or DIA. But I didn't care. I said to myself, if he doesn't know what I know, if the government doesn't know what I know, then maybe we're all in trouble. And therefore, I'm not going to be living my life feeling like I have information that should not be shared with my own government. And that really is a philosophy that I had for a long time. And that's why I would talk openly with the man who worked for the World Bank. And in this particular case, when he called me in December of 1999, in the first week, he said, I have a colleague who is retiring from the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he has heard about, in fact, Linda, I think he has read your book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. He finds a section extremely important, and he wants to talk to you. I said, what section?
Yeah.
And he said, the resurrection technology of tubes. Okay, now,
Linda,
I want to wrap
Linda,
you.
We have to take another break now. Folks, we will be getting back to the resurrection technology of tubes in just a second. Visit earthfiles.com. Do become a subscriber of earthfiles.com. Do get engaged in these sites, in this work. It is becoming more and more important. And because you're listening to this show, you are right at the cutting edge. You matter, and your intelligence and your commitment matter. Your understanding above all matters, and that's one of the main places to gain more understanding. We'll be right back.
When should you subscribe to unknowncountry.com? How about right now? Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab on the masthead. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account.
And do we ever need you right now? And do you ever need us? The new unknowncountry.com is beautiful. It is fully functional. The whole archive is working. It's full of amazing stuff. Plus, this is the only place like it in the world. Keep it going. It's up to you. Go to unknowncountry.com. You know what you have to do. It's only a few pennies a day. It's not a big sacrifice, but it means an awful lot.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and unknowncountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
Okay, Linda, let's just keep right on.
Right. So the Defense Intelligence Agency analyst who was aware of the resurrection technology tubes in my Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2. You have to keep the timeline that I did this two-volume book, Glimpses 1, Facts and Eyewitnesses, and Glimpses 2, High Strangeness, over an eight-year period. And this book did not emerge until the end of the year of 1998 in its first production. That means that when I got the call 1 year later from the World Bank person about the DIA analyst wanting to talk to me about the resurrection technology, the book had been out for 1 year. And when I heard that that is what he wanted to talk to me about, I immediately thought of a very strange phone call that I had received in the month that the book had first emerged a year earlier in the end of 1998. I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and it was a call at approximately 10 or 10:30 in the evening, and I would answer only because I would think the only people calling would be my family. And when I picked up that phone in that house in a northern suburb of Philly, there was no hello. There was no introduction. It was an extremely deep voice that began a phone, one-sided phone relay that I've never forgotten. It said, "Want you to know," imagine this deep, deep, deep male voice, "want you to know that your new book, Glimpses of Other Realities, has stirred up a hornet's nest in MJ-12 in Washington. Hope you are happy. Click."
I love
and
it.
It was, I didn't know whether to expect some people to be breaking down the front of my door or what. But that was it. But it was, when you look at what is in Glimpses Volume 2, that is not in anything else, it is a huge 100-page-something chapter in which I go into the illustrations, the recorded interviews of people in the abduction syndrome who had begun to communicate with me in 1990 for the first time. The book didn't come out until end of 1998. So I may have given that year. I don't mean 1980s. I'm talking about the 1990s only. I hope I didn't do that wrong. I began working on Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and 2, in 1990 to 1998. It was those full 8 years that it took to do the two-volume book. Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, was first released in 1998. And that, in that same first month that it was released, is when I got the spooky, mysterious phone call. It is a year later, at the end of what would have been 1999. This is the December phone call that I got from the man with the World Bank, who said to me that a colleague of his who worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency wanted to know if I would be willing to travel for a three-way meeting with those two men, and that when I asked what the subject was that he was most interested in, that I was told it was the resurrection technology in the this huge chapter in Volume 2 that also had illustrations. I was extremely curious. I wanted then to do the meeting, because the whole reason on the evolution of Volume 2 and why it had become such an important book for me was that I felt that the people who were sending me their drawings of tubes where there was light at the top and the bottom, sustaining a variety of varying different looking bodies, some human, some extraterrestrial, some unknown, was one of the most important parts of my entire series of investigations that had started in 1979, 20 years earlier, with animal mutilations, and that doing the animal mutilations investigations as the director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver, where everything that I did was in a beat of science, medicine, and the environment. That's what I had been in when I was at Stanford University getting a master's degree in communication. I had done my documentaries in the Stanford Linear Accelerator at the very first time they were trying to get computers to analyze the particle bombardments at the Stanford Linear Accelerator. That was my master's thesis. And I had done a film for the Stanford Medical Center that they used for 19 years after I graduated in 1968. They sent me a letter almost 20 years later thanking me for the documentary that I had done during my graduate work at Stanford. So everything, my lens on life and work was always science, medicine, and the environment. That's what I was hired to do at the ABC station in Boston. I did all of their medical and science productions between 1976 and 78 there, and or 74 to 70, almost 78. And that when I went to Denver and married with a husband who was doing corporate work, and that we were moved to Denver from Boston because of his corporate work, I was hired to be director of special projects at the CBS station. And that when the general manager did the interview with me, he said, look, we've had somebody coming through selling your house call and your science programs. And he said, why should I buy the programs when I can purchase or pay for the producer? And that's how I came to be director of special projects in Denver. And it was there that my beat was to be science, medicine, and the environment, as always. And in the fall of 1979, I became aware that there were quote-unquote stories about recurring animal mutilations in the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News, and I wanted to understand what was going on. At first, I thought maybe this was another government Dugway proving ground assault on the environment with a toxin that had killed a lot of sheep.
Yeah.
And then when I started the nine-month project, it became my documentary, A Strange Harvest. It was law enforcement who were looking me straight in the eye and saying, no, the animal mutilations are the work of creatures from outer space, and the reasons they gave were two. You can't remove hearts from inside of 2,000-pound bodies and have no surgery on the surface of the bodies unless you have an instrument that is going down and extracting hearts at a molecular level without any sign of visible surgery on the outside of the body, and this happened over and over. And the second was how many of the ranchers that the law enforcement were interviewing said, I was out at night and I saw a beam coming down from a round circle of light into my pasture, and I watched an animal rise in that beam of light. In the next morning when I was brave enough to go back to the pasture, there was one of my cows dead, mutilated, no blood, no tracks. So that is how I walked through the Alice in Wonderland mirror from being purely a science, medicine, and environment producer, writer, director, editor, and reporter into the world that would lead me off to the questions that you and I have are talking about on this program. And it was an Alice in Wonderland going to what type of other intelligence is interacting with this planet. And today, in December of 2019, you and I are talking about your remarkable new book, A New World, and the profound paradigm shift that you allow the reader to go through as you begin in those early chapters trying to show that if we are dealing with minds that are able to think, see, and arrange atoms, as we would have children that would put blocks of ABC together,
right,
then we have in front of us a brand new universe that's coming. It isn't just the headline, "We are not alone." It is an entire new relationship with the fundamental fabric of Planck's constant. Planck's constant has defined the distance between the atoms at the subatomic level of this particular universe. And if Planck's constant were not what it is, our hands would not stop at tables or solidity.
Right.
We would pass. Our hands would pass.
And they can, manipulate Planck's constant, which means that they are in control, literally, of the structure of the universe as if they were from the outside.
And that's exactly the word that was used for me back after I was working on animal mutilations that automatically led to interviews with people in the abduction syndrome. And remembering that one of the experiencers said to me, when they moved me from the bed through the wall, and I felt a tickling like feathers all over my skin, it was as if they were rheostating the matter of the wall and the matter of my body so that I could move through the spaces of the matter of the wall.
I have felt, and I am sure a lot of the close encounter witnesses listening right now have felt exactly the same sensation under those circumstances.
Yeah, and now, what does it mean that there would be a lot of people in the abduction syndrome suddenly in the year 1990 writing to me all at once, had half a dozen all at once, like the universe was saying, Linda, pay attention. And that what I was getting were illustrations. One package was really, I think, in the category of art from an abductee named Linda Porter, who let me use her real name. And she had the experience of being aboard some kind of space craft, planet, who knows, where she was shown a whole bunch of tubes that had bodies in them, with light above and below. And she recognized some, one even of herself. But what was happening is that she had in front of her the beginning of this entire process was an 8-foot-tall praying mantis. She has did draw for me a really exquisite illustration of this praying mantis. And what she remembered, that the praying mantis high above her, and she feeling like she was a tiny child in face of this, is that the praying mantis telepathed into her young mind, you will experience, this is a quote, you will experience the translation into the light, quote unquote. She didn't know what it meant. And she finds herself in another space. The praying mantis is back where she saw a lot of light in a room that was round. It wasn't square. And that's when the praying mantis said, you will experience the translation into the light. There was no other being around the praying mantis at that moment. But like in so many abduction experiences, nothing is linear. She has that experience with the praying mantis. The next thing she knows, she's in a different room. And there are what she thought was a gray scientist. That's what she thought he was. And he is now communicating to her only telepathically that he is going to demonstrate what is going to happen to her, which 2 + 2 = 4 would equal what the praying mantis called the translation into the light. Now, she gets a demonstration, and the gray being, the scientist, walked over to a man who is lying on what looked just like a, not like a comfortable bed at all, but just like almost like a slab of marble or stone or something. And he's lying there, and she sees, to both her astonishment and horror, that the gray being lifts up its four long fingers that do have nails at the end, and in a very simple, just a kind of a curved motion down to the man's chest, the gray being lifts up, no blood, no fluid, but what she draws as a heart. And then the gray being turns to her watching and explains, this man is going to die in his home in Wisconsin, and it must not be allowed. There is an importance in keeping the entity, which he immediately thought was another word for soul. There, it is very important to keep the entity together with this particular container for a longer time. Therefore, we must construct a new body that the soul will enter, but the body must be the same as this man. And we are going to allow the body that is dying in front of you now because of our demonstration. And we must allow him, and he will be buried in a funeral in Wisconsin. But we are going to take, and then came from one of the tubes, she didn't know how this occurred, one of the people in one of the lighted tubes was clearly a younger version of the man that she had watched have his heart taken out and die. And this younger man is now outside of the tube, and she sees coming out from the top of the spine, she said the area that she understood was where the bones that make the shoulders and cross the spine, that is the exit and entrance of the soul. And that what she was allowed to see is that coming from the man who was dead or dying on that stone table, that came up, she estimated, and her drawings are superb of this, was a sort of fluctuating, almost like you would think of an oscilloscope making waves, only this was vertical waveform in gold white light. Came out, she estimated at least 3 feet long, came right out of that place where the shoulder bones crossed the spine, came up into the air above the gray and above the man that now has to be dead in our world. And this fluctuating, beautiful, alive, nothing about it static light moved across the room to the, she said, the younger version of this man seemed to be standing there, and I didn't know how, but he looked asleep. And then the light came and entered this young, and what else can you do but say cloned body, of the light came down into exactly the spot that it had exited in the dead and dying body, and now is coming into the cloned body that is standing outside the lighted tube. And then the body came alive. The skin took on a pinkness. She described all of this, drew it very well. And then, as she was telling me this, in the original tape-recorded interview that I did with her, I remember we were sitting across from each other, maybe 4 feet. And as she got to this moment, my tape recorder is running on everything. And as she got to this moment, she suddenly extended her hands open up to me, the palms up, and her arms extended to me in that three or four feet distance between us. And she said, almost with alarm, "Linda," and her voice broke. And she began to sob as she spoke. "Linda, whose hands, whose arms are these? Who am I? I watched me die," because they showed her exactly what happened to the man. They showed her dying. "Who? I saw myself die like I saw him die. And then I came alive like he came alive. Linda, who was doing the watching? Which part of me was doing the watching? Which part of me is the body that came alive with the yellow gold light? Which one was in the tube? Who am I now in front of you?" I'll never forget. And at that point, she began what I call vomit, sobbing. And I remember this, Whitley, as if the human evolution of all of us, going back to Homo erectus 2 million years ago, and whatever we are, whatever abuse we have been subjected to by power brokers and intelligences that can work and arrange atoms and put us together, that at that moment of that cry of Linda Porter extending her arms to me, it was, I joined her in her agony and in her question. And as I joined in her sobbing question, it is as if all 7 billion of us on the earth now are being asked to join in that same question, and that what is coming is we've got to be able to face all of those questions. And just like Linda Porter, who then realized that she became one with her cloned body. She is the one in front of me. But I, Linda, could not answer for her which one was doing the watching, which one was the one that had the insertion of the soul, and which one was it that was in the cloned tube. That, to me, Whitley, it isn't anything for us to run from.
No.
I've never run from it.
I don't think so either.
It has excited me. And when all of this that we are talking about is exactly what that Defense Intelligence Agency analyst wanted to ask me in great detail about in December of 1999.
And, of course, it means that we don't have – this is, you know, this is exactly what made it. Gosh, it's what Shakespeare said. This life is a stage and we are all players upon it. And what, one of the first things I heard from Anne after I realized that I could communicate with her after she died, after she proved it to me, which my listeners all know how that happened, was, "This is a game." And I thought, ha ha, game. She didn't say anything, but there was no sense that it was a silly, trivial game. It was a serious game. And, you know, it
– Let me
just finish. What is so incredibly brain-bending about this conversation is that it relates to an event, an encounter event I had in the desert – the second Tuesday of December in 29 Palms, California. It relates directly to what happened during that encounter, where I saw an individual very closely and clearly, whom I've seen once before as an adult and once long ago when he was a child. This is a human being, and he's, I don't know exactly what's going on here. In other words, it's not something I would normally have talked about, but it has come up somehow. In any case, he is a clone of a friend of mine with whom I had the weirdest single experience almost of my life. This friend grew up in Romania, and he's a genius. He now lives in the United States. Now, while he was growing up, he had a close encounter experience of which he remembers nothing except one thing. He underlined a name in a book, a mystery novel that he was reading in Romanian, was told to underline that name, and he underlined the name, and then that was all he had left, was the underlined name and the knowledge that there had been missing time. And the admonition that the name of that person, the person who had been named, had been told that he must never in his life tell what he had seen. Now, flash forward to my meeting this man, not exactly by chance, but close to it, 30 years after that event in his life. And he tells me about his close encounter experience, of course, because of who I am. And then he says, and I say, of course, well, what was the name? When he says the name, I swear to God, I almost fainted. The name was the name of an officer, an intelligence officer. You and I both know. I'm not going to say the name because I would never do that. And I mean, obviously, I don't want to be dragged out of here by my hair by someone from the beyond. So I'm careful about those things. Anyway, it was the name of an intelligence officer who was among the group of people who watched me have a sexual encounter with a visitor who looked like the being on the cover of Communion, which I have written about in Supernatural and referred to briefly in A New World. That was the name he had been given as the event happened all those years ago. Flash forward to the present. Now, that is the way this game works underneath the surface.
Right.
Okay.
I agree with you completely about the fabric of threads that are woven in each of our lives. Looking back, as Kierkegaard said, you must live life forward, but you can only understand it looking backward. And here to me then is a hugely important question for you after all that you've been through and all that you know and the brilliance of your new book. What do you think it means when the gray scientist telepaths to Linda Porter, watching from whichever form she was in? It is critical that the entity that she is telepathed, the definition of entity to the gray was the soul. It is critical that the soul remain with this particular container for a longer period of time, and this is why they were allowing him or facilitating the death of the sick man. But the gray communicated to Linda Porter, we are putting this entity and container together in Australia, where he will never cross paths in this world with his family or relatives in Wisconsin.
This is a weave. Something is, it's like a work of art, that what's being done here. And what's happening on the physical level is like the backside of the tapestry that's being woven. From this side of the tapestry, you can't really see the overall picture, but it's essential that every single thread be in the right place at the right time. That's how I see it. And I do know this from my experience. For all of the negativity and the frightening effects of the close encounter experience, which we are both very familiar with, there is a desire for us to survive, because when push comes to shove, I don't think you can build this tapestry. You can create this tapestry without us. We are an essential, or maybe the essential, ingredient. And that's why all of this weaving is being done, and also why some of us are allowed to see behind the curtain, like you and me and her and all of the listeners now and all of your listeners, because it's important that we understand this. And why is that true? Not because we can change anything, but because our knowledge increases our level of consciousness and enriches the whole tapestry. That's what it's all about. And that we are like, each one of us who comes awake to this is like a little light, bright light that turns on in this vast tapestry of lights until eventually, over time, it will be a huge tapestry of light, and that will be consciousness in this universe.
Well, you and I and others who I think ultimately we feel that there is a divine field, you call it the presence in which all of this is taking place. I've always felt of it as a divine field in which everything is taking place. But you, I, and others also, it's on page 177 of your book, and I put asterisks all along the page 177 because I thought ultimately that as brilliant and penetrating as your work is, you still, in the end, just like me, are they parasitic, here to take without giving, or are they symbiotic, here to share? If they are parasites, then they are the greatest danger we have ever known. If they are here to share, though, then they are literally the pearl of great price, worth giving everything we have to acquire, and I could add the word understand. But the greater preponderance of evidence is that they are real and here, and that our situation is indeed urgent, and that we can find a new way and a new world together. And I ultimately ask at the end of the book, Whitley, why do you think you, I, and so many of us feel that something hugely urgent is at stake right at this moment?
I think that we are coming to what the visitors have recently called, in my interactions with them, an inflection point. That is to say, the species is going to discover that it's at serious jeopardy. Right now.
You mean humans?
Human, yeah.
And you mean political change and climate change that could end up undoing everything?
Right, yeah, that it could run out of control and turn into an extinction event. And whatever this presence is, it does not want that to happen. Whatever they want us for, whether we like that or not, I can't be sure. But I do know they don't want us to become extinct. And this is why they've been... Are you there?
Yeah, right here.
What was that noise?
I heard something that sounded like a squeak.
Well, it's very interesting that it came just as I was talking about the inflection point. And it's not a noise that this system generated. I don't know where it came from. It's just so perfectly placed there. I'm going to leave it in.
Okay.
And so I guess that someone was saying, yes, it is an inflection point. So what we're in is a situation where they are basically, as I understand it, as the planetary environment falls to pieces around us, they're going to get closer and closer to us. This is what I think is going to happen. And I don't know what the time frame is, and probably they don't either, but it will happen that way, I think. And free Dreamlanders, it's also time for us to say goodbye, I think, and I regret that deeply. There were two other inflection points later in the show, and I am going to play for you before we go the three inflection points and what I say about them, because I think they are an important message. I do think that there is some kind of a communication. They're not static, I don't know exactly what they are, but they're not coming from this system. They're not coming from Linda. And they are at particularly crucial points in the discussion. I think there's a message here. Listen up.
A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. A new world. Unforgettable.
Before we conclude the show, I would like to replay those three sort of funny inflection points. Were they just a glitch in the internet? Or was someone trying to communicate with us via, say, something like electronic voice phenomena? One of them occurs when we're actually talking about Dr. Konstantin Rodove, and he was the originator of electronic voice phenomena. At least its main proponent, I should say, not the originator, but its main proponent. Okay, here they are. Here's the first one. It occurs at 57 minutes into the show, just when I say they don't want us to become extinct. Whatever they want us for, whether we like that or not, I can't be sure. But I do know they don't want us to become extinct. And this is why they've been... Are you there?
Yeah, right here.
What was that noise? Now here's the second one at 1 minute 12 and about 30 seconds. I mention Konstantin Rodove, and here this immediately happens. The only other person I know who has a similar effect with a little slit opening up in their eye with words racing through it is an expert on Dr. Konstantin Rodove. So I think... Now here's the third one, and we're talking about the idea that they may be outside of time looking in. So the first one happens when I'm talking about their concern that we may go extinct. The second one, when I'm talking about Dr. Konstantin Rodove, and then the third one, talking about that they may be outside of time. So I see this as a possible communication, frankly. Those aren't sounds that normally affect my system. There have been no others since the show was recorded. It was just those three points in this show, just those three inflection points, as it were. So what are we to conclude from this? Well, they're concerned about us going extinct. Two, Dr. Konstantin Rodove's system of electronic voice communication is involved somehow. And three, they are outside of time. You add those three things together, and you know what this sounds like to me? It sounds like a communication from our own dead, outside of time, concerned about our extinction, and communicating using Dr. Rodove's invention. So here's the third and last one from a minute and 25 in.
And what you articulated in this book is, if they are outside time, completely different than we are, they know everything that's coming, and we live in a state of, we never know what the next second is going to bring,
right,
technically. And therefore, we could be mirror images of, we are in time, some people would say trapped in time, and that we go in spirals of time. They may be.
There you have it. That's the end of the show. Linda Moulton Howe and Whitley Strieber on the cliff's edge of ultra high strangeness. Do we fall or do we fly?
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.